It was a good beginning. Chapter 60. Sistine Chapel. It was fitting that Donati's first official act as Pope was to affix his signature to a document that would reside permanently in the silence of the Vatican secret archives. Hastily prepared by Monsignor Montini, it formally recorded Donati's new name and his acceptance of the position of Supreme Pontiff. He signed the document at the table where the scrutineers and revisers had tabulated the votes. 80 had gone to Donati on the first ballot, a shocking result. Not since the days of election by acclamation had a pope been elected so swiftly and by such an overwhelming margin. Donati next withdrew to the Room of Tears, where a representative of the Gamarelli family, papal tailors since 1798, waited with three white linen cassocks and a selection of rochettes, mozzettas, stoles, and red silk slippers. Pietro Lucchesi had famously chosen the smallest of the three cassocks. Donati required the largest. He dispensed with the rochette, mozzetta, and stole, and chose to wear his old silver-plated pectoral cross rather than the heavy gold cross offered to him. Nor did he select a pair of red slippers. His Italian loafers, which he had shined himself for his appearance before the cardinals at the Casa Santa Marta, were good enough. Gabriel was not permitted to witness Donati's ritual re-robing. He remained in the Sistine Chapel, where the cardinals waited to greet the man to whom they had just handed the keys to the kingdom. The mood was electric, but uncertain. The room's acoustics allowed Gabriel to eavesdrop on a few of the conversations. It was obvious that many of the cardinals had cast so-called complimentary votes for Donati, not realizing that an overwhelming majority of their colleagues intended to do the same. The general consensus was that the Holy Spirit, not Bishop Richter and the Order of St. Helena, had intervened. Not everyone in the room was pleased by the outcome, especially Cardinals Albanese and Tardini. Only 36 had voted for another candidate, which meant a significant number of the 42 conspirators had supported Donati's candidacy, perhaps with the misplaced hope he might overlook their financial transgressions and allow them to remain in their current jobs. Gabriel reckoned the College of Cardinals would soon see a rash of quiet resignations and reassignments. Long overdue change was coming to the Catholic Church. No one knew how to operate the levers of Vatican power better than Luigi Donati. More important, he knew where the bodies were buried and where the dirty laundry was hidden. The Roman Curia, guardian of the status quo, had finally met its match. At last, Donati emerged from the Room of Tears in his snow-white garment, a zucchetto upon his head. He was aglow, as though caught by his own private spotlight. So remarkable was the change in his appearance that even Gabriel scarcely recognized him. He was no longer Luigi Donati, he thought. He was the successor of St. Peter, Christ's representative on earth. He was His Holiness. In a few minutes he would be the most famous and recognizable man in the world. But first, there was a last ritual as old as the church itself. One by one, in order of precedence, the cardinals filed forward to offer their congratulations and pledge their obedience, a reminder that the Pope was not only a spiritual leader of a billion Catholics, but one of the world's last remaining absolute monarchs as well. He chose to receive the cardinals while standing rather than seated on his throne. Most of the exchanges were warm, even boisterous. Several were frigid and tense. Tardini, defiant to the end, wagged his finger at the new Pope, who wagged his finger in return. Domenico Albanese fell to his knees and begged for absolution. Donati told him to rise and then waved him away, with the stain of a pontiff's murder still on his soul. There was a monastery in Albanese's future, thought Gabriel, somewhere cold and isolated, with bad food. Poland, perhaps, or better yet, Kansas. There was one last precedent to be broken that evening. It came at 7:34 p.m., when Donati summoned Gabriel with a joyous wave of his long arm. The new pope seized him by the shoulders. Gabriel had never felt smaller. Congratulations, Holiness. Condolences, you mean? His confident smile made it clear he was already becoming comfortable in the role. You've just seen something only a handful of people have ever witnessed. I'm not sure I'll remember much of it. Nor will I. He lowered his voice. You didn't tell anyone, did you? Not a soul. In that case, our friends at the Jesuit Curia are about to get the surprise of their lives. He seemed to relish the thought. Come with me to the balcony, It's not something you should miss." He went into the Sala Regia, and, followed by much of the conclave, set off along the Hall of Blessings toward the front of the basilica. Unlike his master, Pietro Lucchesi, he did not need to be shown the way. In the antechamber behind the balcony, he solemnly made the sign of the cross as the doors were opened. The roar of the multitude in the square was deafening. He smiled at Gabriel one final time, as the senior cardinal deacon declared, "Abemus papam! We have a pope!" Then he stepped into a corona of blinding white light and was gone. Alone with the cardinals, Gabriel felt suddenly out of place. The man once known as Luigi Donati belonged to them now, not him. Unescorted, he made his way back to the Sistine Chapel. Then he headed downstairs to the bronze doors of the Apostolic Palace. Outside, St. Peter's Square was ablaze with candles and mobile phones. It looked as though a galaxy of stars had fallen to Earth. Gabriel tried Chiara's number, but there was not a cellular connection to be had. He picked his way through Bernini's colonnade. The crowd was delirious. Donati's election was an earthquake. Gabriel finally emerged from the colonnade into the Piazza Papa Pio XII. To reach the Jesuit Curia, he had to somehow make his way to the other side. He soon gave up. A sea of humanity stretched from Donati's feet to the banks of the Tiber. There was nowhere for Gabriel to go. He realized suddenly that Chiara and the children were calling his name. It took a moment to find them. Elated, the children were pointing toward the basilica as though their father were unaware of the fact that his friend was standing on the balcony. Chiara's arms were wrapped around Veronica Marchese, who was weeping uncontrollably. Gabriel tried to reach them, but it was no good. The crowd was impenetrable. Turning, he saw a man in white floating above a key-shaped carpet of golden light. It was a masterwork, he thought. His Holiness, oil on canvas, artist unknown. Part 4. Abemus Papam. Chapter 61. Canareggio, Venice. It was Chiara who secretly informed the Prime Minister that her husband would not be at his desk at Kingsall Boulevard on Monday morning. While purportedly on holiday, he had prevented a massive bombing in Cologne, dealt a severe blow to the ambitions of the European far right, and watched his close friend become the Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. He needed a few days to recuperate. He spent the first three largely confined to the apartment overlooking the Rio della Misericordia, for God, in his infinite wisdom, had inflicted upon Venice a deluge of biblical magnitude. When combined with gale-force winds and an unusually high tide in the lagoon, the results were disastrous. All six of the city's historic sestieri suffered catastrophic flooding, including San Marco, where the crypt of the basilica flooded for only the sixth time in 12 centuries. In Canareggio, the water rose a historic 6.5 feet in a span of just 3 hours. Particularly hard hit was the small island to which the city's Jews were confined in 1516 by the order of Venice's ruling council. The museum in the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo was inundated, as was the ground floor of the Casa Israelitica di Riposo. Waves lapped against the bas-relief Holocaust Memorial, leaving the Carabinieri no choice but to abandon their bulletproof kiosk. Like nearly everyone else in the city, the Allon family huddled behind barricades and sandbags and made the best of it. Raphael and Irene looked upon their watery internment as a great adventure, Gabriel as a blessing. For 3 waterlogged days, they read books aloud, played board games, undertook art projects, and watched every DVD in the apartment's modest library, most twice. It was a glimpse of their future. In retirement, Gabriel would be an expatriate again, a diaspora Jew. He would work when it suited him and devote every spare minute to his children. The clock would slow, his many wounds would heal. This is where his story would end, in the sinking city of churches and paintings at the northern end of the Adriatic. He checked in with Uzi Navot early each morning and late each afternoon. And of course he followed the news from Rome, where Donati wasted little time upsetting the curial apple cart. For a start, there was his decision to reside not in the papal apartments of the Apostolic Palace, but in an unadorned suite in the Casa Santa Marta. His first Angelus, delivered to an audience of some 200,000 pilgrims crammed into St. Peter's Square left little doubt he intended to guide the church in a new direction. But who was this man who now occupied the throne of St. Peter? And what were the circumstances of his shocking and historic election? The author of the Vanity Fair article hopscotched from network to network, describing the magnetic archbishop she had christened Luscious Luigi. Several profiles explored his Jesuit roots and the period during which he served as a missionary in war-torn El Salvador. It was widely assumed, though never proven, that as a young priest, he had been a supporter of the controversial doctrine known as liberation theology. This did not endear him to certain segments of the American political right. Indeed, one conservative referred to him as Pope Che Guevara. Another wondered whether the flooding in Venice, where he had worked for several years, might be a sign of God's displeasure in the conclave's choice. Bound by their vows of secrecy, the cardinal electors refused to discuss what had transpired inside the Sistine Chapel. Even Alessandro Ricci, the dogged investigative reporter from La Repubblica, appeared unable to penetrate the conclave's armor. Instead, he published a lengthy article on the links between the European far right and the Order of St. Helena, the reactionary Catholic fraternity about which he had written a best-selling book. Three of the figures implicated in the false flag bombings in Germany, Jonas Wolff, Andreas Estermann, and Axel Brunner, were alleged to be secret members of the order. So too were Austrian Chancellor Jörg Kaufmann and Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Saviano. Kaufmann immediately denied the report. He was forced to issue a clarification when La Repubblica published a photograph from his wedding, which was officiated by the order's superior general, Bishop Hans Richter. For his part, Saviano brazenly dismissed the story as fake news and called upon Italian prosecutors to file charges of treason against its author. Informed that no such offense had been committed, he issued a tweet calling on his thuggish soccer hooligan supporters to teach Ricci a lesson he would not soon forget. After receiving hundreds of death threats, the journalist fled his apartment in Trastevere and went into hiding. Bishop Richter, secluded at the order's medieval priory in Canton Zug, refused to comment on the story. Nor did he issue a statement when lawyers in New York filed a class action suit in federal court accusing the order of extorting money and valuables from desperate Jews during the late 1930s in exchange for promises of false baptismal certificates and protection from the Nazis. The lead plaintiff in the case was Isabel Feldman, the only surviving child of Samuel Feldman. In a sparsely attended news conference in Vienna, she unveiled a painting, a river landscape by the Dutch old master Jan van Hooyen, that her father had turned over to the order in 1938. The canvas, which had been removed from its stretcher, had been returned to her by the noted Holocaust investigator, Elie Lavon, whose schedule did not permit him to attend the press briefing. The exact circumstances of the painting's recovery were not made public, which gave rise to much unfounded speculation in the Austrian press. A website that regularly trafficked in false or misleading stories went so far as to accuse Lavon of being an Israeli agent. The story happened to be accurate, thus proving Rabbi Jacob Zolli's contention that the unimaginable can happen. Normally, Gabriel would not have bothered with a response. But given the current climate of anti-Semitism in Europe and the ever-present threat of violence hanging over Austria's tiny Jewish minority, he thought it best to issue a denial through the Israeli embassy in Vienna. He was less inclined, however, to repudiate a British tabloid report regarding his presence in the Sistine Chapel on the night of the historic conclave, if only to annoy the Russians and the Iranians, who were rightly paranoid about his capabilities and reach. But when the story jumped from publication to publication like a contagion, he reluctantly instructed the Prime Minister's irascible spokeswoman to dismiss it as preposterous on its face. The statement was a classic example of a non-denial denial. And with good reason. Numerous Vatican insiders, including the new Supreme Pontiff and the 116 cardinals who elected him, knew the story to be true. So too did Gabriel's children. For three blissful days, as the rains fell upon Venice without relent, he had them entirely to himself. Board games, art projects, old movies on DVD. Occasionally, when the combination of shadows and light was favorable, he lifted the flap of an envelope emblazoned with the armorial of His Holiness Pope Paul VII and removed the three sheets of rich stationery. The salutation was informal, first name only. There were no preliminaries or pleasantries. While researching in the Vatican secret archives, I came upon a most remarkable book. Finally, on the morning of the fourth day, the clouds parted, and the sun shone over the whole of the city. After breakfast, Gabriel and Chiara dressed the children in oilskin coats and Wellington boots, and together they waded over to the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo to assist with the cleanup. Nothing had been spared, especially the museum's beautiful bookstore, which lost most of its inventory. The kitchen and common room of the Casa Israelitica di Riposo were in ruins, and both the Portuguese and Spanish synagogues suffered severe damage. Once again, thought Gabriel, as he surveyed the destruction, calamity had befallen the Jews of Venice. They worked until one and then took their lunch in a tiny restaurant hidden away on the Calle Massena. From there it was a short walk to the first of two apartments that Chiara, without bothering to inform Gabriel, had arranged for them to see that day. It was large and airy and, perhaps most important, dry as a bone. The kitchen was newly renovated, as were the three bathrooms. The price was high, but not unreasonable. Gabriel was confident he would be able to shoulder the additional financial burden without having to sell knockoff Gucci handbags to the tourists in San Marco. "What do you think?" asked Chiara. "Nice," said Gabriel noncommittally. "But?" "Why don't you show me the other apartment?" It was located near the San Tomma Vaporetto stop on the Grand Canal, a fully refurbished piano nobile with a private roof terrace and a high-ceilinged, light-filled room that Gabriel could claim as a studio. There he would toil night and day on lucrative private commissions in order to pay for it all. He consoled himself with the knowledge that there were far worse ways for a man to spend the autumn of his years.
"If we sell Narcus Street," said Chiara.
"We're not going to sell it."
"I know it's a stretch, Gabriel, but if we're going to live in Venice, wouldn't you prefer to live here?"
"Who wouldn't? But someone has to pay for it."
"Someone will."
"You?" She smiled. "I want to see his books. Where do you think we were going next?" Francesco Tiepolo's office was on the Calle Larga 22 Marzo in San Marco. On the wall behind his desk were several framed photographs of his friend Pietro Lucchesi. In one was a youthful version of Lucchesi's successor.
"I suppose you had something to do with it?"
"What's that?"
"The election of the first pope from outside the College of Cardinals since the 13th century.
14th, said Gabriel. "And rest assured, it was the Holy Spirit who chose the new pope, not me."
"You've been spending too much time in Catholic churches, my friend."
"It's an occupational hazard." Tiepolo's books were hardly immaculate, but they were in far better shape than Gabriel had feared. The firm had little debt, and the monthly overhead was low. Mainly, it consisted of the rent for the San Marco office and a warehouse on the mainland. At present, the firm had more work than it could handle, and several projects were in the pipeline. Two were scheduled to commence after the date of Gabriel's retirement, which meant Chiara would be able to hit the ground running. Tiepolo insisted they keep the firm's name and pay him a 50% share of the annual profit. Gabriel agreed to keep the name. He did not want his many enemies to know where he was living, but he balked at Tiepolo's demand for half of the company's profits, offering him 25% instead.
"How will I possibly live on such a paltry sum?"
"Somehow you'll manage." Tiepolo looked at Chiara.
"Which apartment did he choose?"
"The big one." "I knew it!"
Tiepolo clapped Gabriel on the back.
"I always said you would return to Venice. And when you die, they'll bury you beneath a cypress tree on San Michele in an enormous crypt befitting a man of your achievements."
"I'm not dead yet, Francesco."
"It happens to the best of us."
Tiepolo gazed at the photographs on the wall.
"Even to my dear friend, Pietro Lucchesi.
And now Donati is the Pope."
"Are you sure you didn't have anything to do with it?"
"No," answered Gabriel distantly. "It was him."
"Who?"
asked Tiepolo, perplexed. Gabriel pointed toward the cloaked, sandaled figure walking past Tiepolo's window. It was Father Joshua. Chapter 62. Piazza San Marco. Gabriel hurried into the street. Like most in San Marco, it was covered in several inches of water. A few tourists were milling about in the dying twilight. None seemed to notice the man in a threadbare cloak and sandals.
"What are you looking at?"
Gabriel wheeled around to find Chiara and the children standing behind him. He pointed along the darkening street. The man in the hooded cloak is Father Joshua. He's the one who gave us the first page of the Gospel of Pilate. Chiara narrowed her eyes. I don't see anyone in a cloak. Neither did Gabriel. The priest had disappeared from view. Maybe you were mistaken, said Chiara. Or maybe you just thought you saw him. A hallucination, you mean? Chiara said nothing. Wait here. Gabriel set off along the street, searching for a destitute-looking clergyman amid the world's most exclusive storefronts. Eventually he passed through an archway beneath the Museo Correa and emerged into the Piazza San Marco. Father Joshua was walking past Café Florian toward the Campanile. The priest seemed to move across the floodwaters without disturbing the surface. He made no attempt to lift the hem of his garment. Gabriel hastened after him. Father Joshua? The priest stopped at the foot of the bell tower. Gabriel addressed him in Italian, the language he had spoken in the manuscript depository of the secret archives. Don't you remember me, Father Joshua? I'm the one who... I know who you are. His smile was benevolent. You're the one with the name of the archangel. How do you know my name? There were recriminations after your visit to the secret archives. I overheard things. Do you work there? Why would you ask such a question? Your name doesn't appear on the staff directory, and unless I'm mistaken, you weren't wearing any identification that day. Why would someone like me require identification? Who are you? Who do you say that I am? His Italian was beautiful, but it was colored with an unmistakable accent. Do you speak Arabic? Asked Gabriel. Like you, I speak many languages. Where are you from? The same place you are. Israel? The Galilee. Why are you in Venice? I came to see a friend. He noticed Gabriel looking at his hands. I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus, he explained. Two women splashed past them. They stared at Gabriel apprehensively, but seemed not to notice the man standing in ankle-deep water in sandals and a cloak. Were you ever able to find the rest of the gospel? He asked. Not before it was destroyed. The Holy Father was afraid that would happen. Were you the one who gave it to him? Of course. How were you able to open the door of the collezione without a key? He gave a sly smile. It wasn't difficult. Did the Holy Father show the book to anyone else? A Jesuit, Father Joshua frowned. For some reason, my word wasn't good enough. The Jesuit agreed with me that the book was authentic. He's an American, this Jesuit? Yes. Do you know his name? The Holy Father refused to tell me. He said he was going to give the gospel to you when the Jesuit was finished with it. Finished with what? His Holiness didn't say. Where were you when you had this conversation? The papal study. But why do you ask? The men who murdered the Holy Father were listening. They could hear his voice, but not yours. His expression darkened. You must feel guilty. About what? His death. Yes, admitted Gabriel. Terribly guilty. Don't, said the priest. It wasn't your fault. He turned to leave. Father Joshua. The priest stopped. When did you remove the first page of the gospel? He raised a bandaged hand. I'm afraid I must be on my way. May the peace of the Lord be with you always, and with your wife and children as well. Go to them, Gabriel. They're searching for you. With that, he set off between the columns of St. Mark and St. Theodore. Gabriel quickly drew his phone and engaged the camera, but he could see no trace of the priest on the screen. He hurried over to the gondola station on the river degli Scavoni and looked to the right and then the left. Father Joshua was gone. At 2 p.m. the following afternoon, Gabriel received a phone call from General Cesare Ferrari of the Art Squad. He claimed to have come to Venice on an unrelated matter and was hoping Gabriel might have a moment to answer a few questions before his return to Israel. Where? Carabinieri Regional Headquarters. Gabriel suggested Harry's bar instead. He arrived a few minutes before 4, the general a few minutes after. They ordered Bellinis. Gabriel's immediately gave him a headache. He drank it nonetheless. It was irresistibly delicious. Besides,
It was his last day of vacation.
The perfect end to an imperfect day, said the general.
What is it now?
Next year's budget.
I thought fascists love cultural patrimony.
Only if there's enough tax revenue to pay for it.
I guess bashing immigrants isn't good for the economy after all.
Is it true they were responsible for the flooding here in Venice?
That's what I read on Russia Today.
And did you happen to read Alessandro Ricci's article in La Repubblica this morning?
The general plucked an enormous green olive from the bowl in the center of the table. The chattering classes think Saviano's coalition might not survive.
What a shame.
They say a private audience with the wildly popular new pope would do wonders for his position.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
His Holiness might want to reconsider, in light of the fact that he was in Florence the night that Swiss guard was killed. If memory serves, you were there too. And then there's that missing priest from the Order of St. Helena. His name escapes me.
Father Graf.
You wouldn't happen to know where he is, would you?
Not a clue, answered Gabriel truthfully.
Perhaps someday you'll tell me how all the pieces of this affair fit together.
The general ordered two more Bellinis and surveyed the interior of Harry's bar.
They did a remarkable job with the repairs. You wouldn't even know there was a flood.
He gave Gabriel a sidelong glance.
I suppose you'll get used to it.
You've obviously been talking to Francesco Tiepolo.
Ferrari smiled. He tells me you're going to be working for your wife soon.
She hasn't accepted my terms yet.
You think she might allow me to borrow you from time to time?
For what?
I'm in the business of recovering stolen paintings. And you, my friend, are very good at finding things.
Except for the Gospel of Pilate.
Ah, yes, the Gospel.
The general removed a manila folder from his briefcase and laid it on the table.
That sheet of paper you gave me was produced by a mill near Bologna. A small operation, one man in fact. Very high quality. We've found numerous examples of his work in other cases.
What kind of cases?
Forgeries.
Ferrari opened the folder and removed the first page of the Gospel. It was still encased in protective plastic.
It looks like it was produced during the Renaissance. In truth, it was manufactured a few months ago,
which means the Gospel of Pilate, the book that led to the murder of His Holiness Pope Paul VII, is a fraud.
How are you able to date it so precisely?
The papermaker is on my payroll. I paid him a visit after my lab delivered its findings.
Ferrari tapped the page.
It was part of a large order of reproduction Renaissance paper, several hundred sheets, in fact. The size was appropriate for bookbinding. It cost the buyer a small fortune.
Who was he?
A priest, actually.
Does the priest have a name?
Father Robert Jordan.
Chapter 63. Venice, Assisi.
It had been Gabriel's intention to return to Israel the following morning on the 10 o'clock El Al flight from Venice's Marco Polo Airport. He instructed travel to book four seats on the evening flight from Rome instead. The car, a Volkswagen Passat, he saw to himself. They departed Venice at 7:30, a full 30 minutes later than he had hoped, and arrived in Assisi a few minutes after noon. With Chiara and the children at his side, he rang the bell at the Abbey of St. Peter. Receiving no answer, he rang it again. At length, Don Simon, the English Benedictine, answered.
Good afternoon, may I help you?
I'm here to see Father Jordan.
Is he expecting you?
No.
Your name?
Gabriel Alon, I was here with...
I remember you.
But why do you wish to see Father Jordan again?
Gabriel crossed his fingers.
I was sent by the Holy Father. I'm afraid it's a matter of some urgency.
There was a silence of several seconds, then the lock snapped open.
Gabriel looked at Chiara and smiled.
Membership has its privileges.
The monk led them to the common room overlooking the abbey's green garden. 10 minutes elapsed before he returned with Father Jordan.
The American Jesuit did not appear pleased to see the friend of the new Roman pontiff.
At length he looked at Don Simon.
Perhaps you should give Signor Alon's wife and children a tour of the grounds. They're really quite beautiful. Chiara glanced at Gabriel, who nodded once. A moment later, he and Father Jordan had the room to themselves.
Are you really here at the behest of the Holy Father? Asked the priest.
No.
I admire your honesty.
I wish I could say the same. Father Jordan moved to the window.
How much of the story have you managed to piece together?
I know that almost everything you told us was a lie, beginning with your name. I also know that you recently took delivery of a large order of reproduction Renaissance paper, which you used to produce a book called The Gospel of Pilate. The question is, was the gospel a fraud? Or was it a copy of the original?
Do you have an opinion?
I'm betting it was a copy. Father Jordan beckoned for Gabriel to join him at the window. Together they watched Chiara and the children walking along a garden path at the side of the Benedictine monk.
You have a beautiful family, Mr. Adlon. Every time I see Jewish children, I think they are a miracle.
And when you see a Jesuit pope,
I see your handiwork.
Father Jordan gave him a conspiratorial smile.
Shouldn't you be in Israel?
We're on our way to the airport.
When is your flight?
6 o'clock. Father Jordan looked down at the two small children playing in the garden.
In that case, Mr. Adlon, I believe you have just enough time for one last story.
He began by taking issue with Gabriel on a small but not insignificant point. His legal name, he said, was in fact Robert Jordan. His mother and father had changed the family name shortly after they arrived in America in 1939 as refugees from Europe. They chose an anglicized version of their real surname, which was the Italian word for the river that flows from the northern Galilee to the Dead Sea.
Giordano, said Gabriel.
Father Robert Jordan nodded.
My father was the son of a wealthy Roman businessman named Emanuele Giordano. One of three sons, he added pointedly. My mother was from an old family called Del Vecchio. The name is quite common among Italian Jews. I must admit I thought my own name was rather dull in comparison. I considered changing it many times, especially when I moved to Italy to teach at the Gregoriana.
How on earth did the child of two Jews become a Catholic priest?
My parents were never very religious, even when they lived in Rome. When they came to America, they masqueraded as Catholics in order to blend in with their surroundings. It wasn't difficult for them. As Romans, they were used to the rituals of Catholicism. But I was the real thing. I was baptized and received my first communion. I even served as an altar boy in our parish church. I can only imagine what my poor parents were thinking when they saw me up there in my little vestments.
How did they react when you told them you wanted to become a priest?
My father could scarcely look at me in my cassock and Roman collar.
Why didn't he tell you the truth?
Guilt, I suppose. At having forsaken his faith?
My father never abandoned his faith, said Father Jordan, even when he was pretending to be a Catholic.
He was guilty because he and my mother had survived the war. They didn't want me to know that their relatives weren't so lucky. They were ensnared in the Rome Roundup in October 1943, and sent to Auschwitz, where they were murdered, all without a word of protest from the Holy Father, despite the fact that it took place under his very windows.
And you became a Catholic priest.
Imagine that.
When did you learn the truth?
It wasn't until November 1989, when I returned to Boston to attend my father's funeral. After the service, my mother gave me a letter he had written after I went off to the seminary. Obviously, it came as quite a shock. Not only was I Jewish, I was a surviving remnant of a family that had perished in the Holocaust.
Did you ever consider renouncing your vows?
Of course.
Why didn't you?
I decided I could be both a Christian and a Jew. After all, Jesus was a Jew. So were the 12 apostles whose statues stand guard over the portico of the Basilica.
12 apostles, he repeated, one each for the 12 tribes of Israel.
The original Christians didn't see themselves as founders of a new faith. They were Jews who were also Jesus' followers. I saw myself in a similar light.
Do you still believe in the divinity of Jesus?
I'm not sure I ever did. But neither did they. They believed Jesus was a man who had been exalted into heaven, not a supreme being who had been sent to earth. All that came much later, after the Gospels had been written and the early church settled on Christianity's orthodoxy. That is when the great sibling rivalry began. The church fathers declared that the covenant between God and his chosen people had been broken, that the old law had been replaced by the new. God had sent his Son to save the world, and the Jews had rejected him. Then, for good measure, they had cleverly maneuvered a gullible and blameless Roman prefect into nailing him to a cross. For such a people, the murderers of God himself, no punishment was too severe. They were your people, said Gabriel. Which is why I made it my life's work to heal the wounds between Judaism and Christianity. By finding the Gospel of Pilate? Father Jordan nodded. I assume your father's letter contained a reference to it. He wrote about it in considerable detail. And that story you told Donati and me the other day, the one about you wandering the length and breadth of Italy searching for the last copy of the Gospel of Pilate? It was just that, a story. I knew that Father Schiller gave the book to Pius XII, and that Pius buried it deep in the archives.
How?
I confronted Father Schiller not long before he died. At first, he tried to deny the book's existence, but when I showed him my father's letter, he told me the truth. Did you tell him that I was the grandson of the wealthy Roman Jew who had given the book to the order? Father Jordan shook his head. Much to my everlasting shame, I did not. Did you really try to find it, or was that a story too? No, said Father Jordan. I searched the archives for more than 20 years. Because there's no reference to the gospel in the index rooms, it was a bit like looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. About 10 years ago, I forced myself to stop. That book was ruining my life. And then? Someone gave it to the Holy Father. And the Holy Father decided to give it to you.
Chapter 64 Abbey of St. Peter, Assisi. At first he thought it was a practical joke. Yes, the voice on the phone sounded like the Holy Father's, but surely it couldn't really be him. He wanted Father Jordan to come to the papal apartments the following evening at 9:30. Father Jordan was to tell no one of the summons, nor was he to arrive even a minute early. I assume it was a Thursday, said Gabriel. How did you know? Gabriel smiled and, with a movement of his hand, invited Father Jordan to continue. He arrived at the papal apartment, he said, at the stroke of 9:30. A household nun escorted him to the private chapel. The Holy Father greeted him warmly, refusing to allow him to kiss the ring of the fisherman, and then showed him a most remarkable book. Do Lucchese know of your personal connection to the gospel?
No, said Father Jordan, and I never told him about it. It was my personal connection to Donati that was important. The Holy Father trusted me. It was just a stroke of dumb luck. I assume he allowed you to read it. Of course. That's why I was there. He wanted my opinion as to its authenticity. And? The text was lucid, at times bureaucratic and granular in its detail. It was not the work of a creative mind. It was an important historical document based on the written or spoken recollections of its nominal author. What happened next? He invited me back the following Thursday. Once again, Donati was absent. Dinner with a friend, apparently. Outside the walls. That was when the Holy Father told me that he planned to give the book to you. He paused, then added, without informing the Prefetto of the Vatican secret archives. Did he know Albanese was a secret member of the Order of St. Helena? He suspected as much. Which is why Lucchese asked you to make a copy of the book. Father Jordan smiled. Rather ingenious, don't you think? Did you do the work yourself, or did you utilize the services of a professional? A little of both. I was a rather talented illustrator and calligrapher when I was young. Not like you, of course, but I wasn't bad. The professional, who shall remain nameless,
handled the artificial aging of the paper and the binding. It was an extraordinary piece of work. Colonel Albanese would never have been able to tell the difference, not unless he subjected the volume to sophisticated tests. But which version of the Gospel did he remove from the papal apartments the night of the Holy Father's murder?
It was the copy, answered Father Jordan. I have the original. The Holy Father gave it to me for safekeeping in case something happened to him.
That book belongs to me now. It belonged to my grandfather before it was taken from him by the order. Therefore, I am the rightful owner, just as Isabel Feldman was the rightful owner of that painting that magically resurfaced last weekend.
Father Jordan scrutinized him for a moment. I suppose you had something to do with that, too.
Gabriel made no reply.
It never goes away, does it?
What's that?
The survivor's guilt. It gets passed down from generation to generation, like those green eyes of yours.
They were my mother's eyes.
Was she in one of the camps?
Birkenau.
Then you are a miracle, too.
Father Jordan patted the back of Gabriel's hand.
I'm afraid there is a straight line between the teachings of the early church and the gas chambers and crematoria of Auschwitz. To maintain otherwise is to engage in what Thomas Aquinas called an ignorantia affectata, a willful ignorance.
Perhaps you should put it to rest once and for all.
And how would I do that?
By giving me that book.
Father Jordan shook his head. Making it public will accomplish nothing. In fact, given the current climate here in Europe and America, it might make matters worse.
Are you forgetting that your former student is now the Pope?
His Holiness has enough problems to deal with. The last thing he needs is a challenge to the core beliefs of Christianity.
What does the book say?
Father Jordan was silent.
Please, said Gabriel, I must know.
He contemplated his sun-baked hands. One central element of the Passion narratives is undeniable. A Jew from the village of Nazareth, named Jesus, was put to death by the Roman prefect on or about the holiday of Passover, and perhaps the year 33 CE. Much else of what was written in the four Gospels must be taken with a cartload of salt. The accounts are literary invention, or worse, a deliberate effort on the part of the evangelists and early church to implicate the Jews in the death of Jesus while simultaneously exculpating the real culprits.
Pontius Pilate and the Romans. Father Jordan nodded.
For example, the trial before the Sanhedrin. Did it happen? In the middle of the night, during Passover?
Father Jordan shook his head.
Such a gathering would have been forbidden by the laws of Moses. Only a Christian living in Rome could have concocted something so outlandish.
Was Caiaphas involved in any way?
If he was, Pilate makes no mention of it.
What about the tribunal?
If that's what you want to call it, said Father Jordan. It was very brief. Pilate barely looked at him. In fact, he claimed not to be able to recall Jesus' physical appearance. He merely jotted a note for his files and waved his hand, and the soldiers got on with it. Many other good Jews were executed that day. As far as Pilate was concerned, it was business as usual.
Was there a crowd present?
Heavens, no.
What was the charge against Jesus?
The only crime punishable by crucifixion.
Insurrection.
Of course.
Where did the incident take place?
The royal portico of the temple.
And the arrest?
The bells of Assisi tolled 2 o'clock before Father Jordan could answer. I've told you too much already. Besides, you and your family have a plane to catch.
He rose and extended his hand.
God bless you, Mr. Alon, and safe travels.
There were footfalls outside in the corridor. A moment later, Chiara and the children appeared in the doorway, accompanied by the Benedictine monk.
Perfect timing, said Father Jordan. Don Simon will show you out.
The monk saw them into the street and then quickly closed the gate. Gabriel stood there for a moment afterward, his hand hovering over the intercom until Irene finally tugged at his sleeve and looked up at him with the face of his mother.
What's wrong, Abba? Why are you crying?
I was thinking about something sad, that's all.
What?
You, thought Gabriel. I was thinking about you. He lifted the child into his arms and carried her through the Porta San Pietro to the parking garage where he had left the car. After buckling Raphael's seatbelt, he searched the undercarriage more carefully than usual before finally climbing behind the wheel.
Try starting the engine, said Chiara.
It helps. Gabriel's hand shook as he pressed the button.
Maybe I should drive.
I'm fine.
Are you sure about that?
He reversed out of the space and followed the ramp to the surface. The only road out of the city took them past the Porta San Pietro. Framed by the archway, like a figure in a Bellini, was a white-haired priest, an old leather satchel in his hand. Gabriel slammed on the brakes and climbed out. Father Jordan offered him the bag as though it contained a bomb.
Be careful, Mr. Alon. Everything is at stake.
Gabriel embraced the old priest and hurried back to the car. Chiara opened the satchel as they sped down the slopes of Monte Subasio. Inside was the last copy of the Gospel of Pilate.
Can you read it? He asked.
I have a master's degree in the history of the Roman Empire. I think I can handle a few lines of Latin.
What does it say?
She read the first two sentences aloud.
Solus ego sum reus mortis eius. Ego crimen oportet.
Translated,
I alone am responsible for his death. I alone must bear the guilt.
She looked up. Shall I keep going?
No,
he said. That's enough. Chiara returned the book to the satchel.
What do you suppose normal people do on vacation?
We are normal people. Gabriel laughed. We just have interesting friends.
Author's note. The Order is a work of entertainment and should be read as nothing more. The names, characters, places, and incidents portrayed in the story are the product of the author's imagination or have been used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, businesses, companies, events, or locales is entirely coincidental. Visitors to Munich will search in vain for the headquarters of a German conglomerate known as the Wolf Group, for no such company exists. Nor will one find a restaurant and jazz bar in the Beethovenplatz called Café Adagio. Thankfully, there is no far-right German political party known as the National Democrats, but there are several like it, including the Alternative for Germany, now the third largest party in Germany, with 94 seats in the Bundestag. BFV chief Hans-Georg Maaßen faced calls for his resignation in 2018 over accusations that he harbored extremist political views himself and was quietly working to assist the Alternative for Germany's rise to power. There is no restricted section of the Vatican secret archives known as the Collezione, at least not one I uncovered during my research. Deepest apologies to the Prefetto for shutting down his power supply and security system, but I'm afraid there was no other way for Gabriel and Luigi Donati to enter the manuscript depository undetected. They could not have been given the first page of the Gospel of Pilate because such a book does not exist. The other apocryphal Gospels mentioned in the order are accurately depicted or are the words of early church figures such as Origen, Tertullian, and Justin Martyr. It was Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone who undertook the ambitious renovation of two apartments in the Palazzo San Carlo to create a 6,500-square-foot luxury flat with a rooftop terrace. But Bertone's dwelling was a hovel compared to the palace in Limburg, Germany, that Bishop Franz Peter Tebartz von Elst, the so-called Bishop of Bling, renovated at a reported cost of $40 million. In May 2012, Ettore Gotti Tedeschi was removed as president of the Vatican Bank in connection with a sex and money scandal that became known as VatiLeaks. An internal Vatican dossier on the rampant corruption of senior church officials reportedly influenced the 2013 conclave that elected Pope Francis. The Vatican Secretariat of State condemned the media's pre-conclave reporting on the scandal as an attempt to interfere in the selection of the next Supreme Pontiff. Former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick of Washington, D.C., reportedly funneled more than $600,000 from a little-known archdiocese account to friends and benefactors at the Vatican, including Popes John Paul II
and Benedict XVI. The Washington Post found that several of the Vatican bureaucrats who received money were directly involved in assessing allegations of sexual misconduct leveled against McCarrick, which included accusations that he solicited sex while hearing confessions. An Episcopal Conference of Switzerland report released on July 2018 found a startling increase in new accusations of sexual abuse against Swiss priests. It is little wonder that Swiss Catholics, including my fictitious Christoph Pittel, have turned their backs on the church in droves. There is indeed a Catholic fraternity based in the Swiss village of Wenzingen, but it is not the fictitious Order of St. Helena. It is the Society of St. Pius X, or SSPX, the reactionary anti-Semitic order founded in 1970 by Bishop Marcel François Lefebvre. Bishop Lefebvre was the son of a wealthy French factory owner who supported the restoration of France's monarchy. During World War II, then Father Lefebvre was an unapologetic supporter of the Vichy regime of Marshal Philippe Pétain, which collaborated with the SS in the destruction of France's Jews. Paul Touvier, a senior officer in the notorious Vichy militia known as the Milice, found sanctuary at an SSPX priory in Nice after the war. Arrested in 1989, Touvier was the first Frenchman to be convicted of crimes against humanity. Not surprisingly, Bishop Lefebvre also expressed support for Jean-Marie Le Pen, leader of France's far-right National Front and a convicted Holocaust denier. Monsieur Le Pen shared that distinction with Richard Williamson, one of four SSPX priests whom Lefebvre elevated to the rank of bishop in 1988 in defiance of a direct order from Pope John Paul II. Williamson, who is British, routinely referred to Jews as the enemies of Christ, whose goal was world domination. While serving as rector of the SSPX's North American Seminary in Winona, Minnesota, Williamson declared, "There was not one Jew killed in the gas chambers. It was all lies, lies, lies." He was expelled from the Society of St. Pius X in 2012, but not for his anti-Semitic views. The SSPX called his removal a painful decision. By the time of his death in 1991, Bishop Lefebvre was a doctrinal outcast and something of an embarrassment. But during the 1930s, as storm clouds gathered over Europe's Jews, a prelate who espoused views similar to Lefebvre's would have found himself largely in the Catholic mainstream. The Church's preference for monarchies and right-wing dictators over socialists or even liberal Democrats has been painstakingly documented, along with the appalling anti-Semitism of many of the Vatican's leading spokesmen and policymakers. While a few Catholic clerics supported the physical elimination of Jews from European society, the Vatican newspaper, La Salvatore Romano, and the Jesuit journal La Civiltà Cattolica cheered laws in Hungary, for example, that purged Jews from professions such as the law, medicine, banking, and journalism. When Benito Mussolini enacted similar restrictions in Italy in 1938, the men of the Vatican could muster scarcely a word of protest. "The terrible truth," wrote historian Suzanne Zuccotti in her remarkable study of the Holocaust in Italy, under his very windows, was that they wanted the Jews put in their place. That was certainly true of Bishop Alois Hudal, rector of the Austrian German Church in Rome. It was Bishop Hudal, not my fictitious Father Schiller, who wrote a viciously anti-Semitic book in 1936 that tried to reconcile Catholicism and National Socialism. In the copy he sent to Adolf Hitler, Hudal penned an adulatory inscription to the architect of German greatness. An Austrian national who was said to be obsessed with Jews, Bishop Hudal moved about Rome throughout the war in a chauffeured car that flew the flag of Greater Germany. 2.5 years after the Allied victory, he hosted a Christmas party attended by hundreds of Nazi war criminals living in Rome under his protection. With Hudal's help, many would find sanctuary in South America. Adolf Eichmann received assistance from Bishop Hudal, as did Franz Stangl, the commandant of the Treblinka extermination camp, all with the knowledge and tacit support of Pope Pius XII, who believed such monsters to be a valuable asset in the global fight against Soviet communism. Pius's critics and apologists have engaged in a decades-long quarrel over his failure to explicitly condemn the Holocaust and warn Europe's Jews about the death camps. But his indefensible support of wanted Nazi mass murderers is perhaps the clearest evidence of his innate hostility toward Jews. Pius opposed the Nuremberg trials, opposed the creation of a Jewish state, and opposed post-war attempts to reconcile Christianity with the faith from which it had sprung. He excommunicated every communist on earth in 1949, but never took a similar step against members of the Nazi Party or the murderous SS. Nor did he ever explicitly express remorse over the death of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. The process of Jewish-Christian reconciliation would therefore have to wait until Pius's death in 1958. His successor, Pope John XXIII, took extraordinary steps to protect Jews during World War II while serving as papal nuncio in Istanbul, including issuing them life-saving false passports. He was old when the ring of the fisherman was placed on his finger, and sadly, his reign was brief. Not long before his death in 1963, he was asked whether there was anything to be done about the devastating portrayal of Pius XII in Rolf Hochhuth's searing play, The Deputy. "Do against it?" the incredulous Pope reportedly replied. "What does one do against the truth?" The culmination of John XXIII's bid to repair relations between Catholics and Jews in the wake of the Holocaust was the milestone declaration of the Second Vatican Council, known as Nostra Aetate. Opposed by many church conservatives, it declared that Jews were not collectively responsible for the death of Jesus, or eternally cursed by God. The great historical tragedy is that such a statement had to be issued in the first place. But for nearly 2,000 years, the church taught that Jews as a people were guilty of deicide, the very murder of God. "The blood of Jesus," wrote Origen, "falls not only on the Jews of that time, but on all generations of Jews up to the end of the world." Pope Innocent III wholeheartedly agreed. "Their words, 'May his blood be on us and our children,' have brought inherited guilt upon the entire nation, which follows them as a curse where they live and work, when they are born and when they die." Were such words spoken today, they would rightly be branded as hate speech. The ancient Christian charge of deicide is universally regarded by scholars as the foundation of anti-Semitism, and yet the Second Vatican Council, when issuing its historic repudiation, could not resist including the following 17 words. "True, authorities of the Jews and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Christ." But what source did the bishops use to justify such an unequivocal declaration about an event that took place in a remote corner of the Roman Empire nearly 2,000 years earlier? The answer, of course, was that they relied on the accounts of Jesus' death contained in the four Gospels of the New Testament, the very source of the vicious slander they were at long last disavowing. Needless to say, the Second Vatican Council did not suggest excising the inflammatory passages from the Christian canon, but Nostra Aetate nevertheless set in motion a scholarly reappraisal of the canonical Gospels that is reflected in the pages of the Order. Christians who believe in biblical inerrancy will no doubt take issue with my description of who the evangelists were and how their Gospels came to be written. Most biblical scholars would not. No original draft of any of the four canonical Gospels survives, only fragments of later copies. It is widely accepted by scholars that none of the Gospels, with the possible exception of Luke, were written by the men for whom they are named. It was the apostolic Father Papias of Hierapolis who in the second century provided the earliest extant account of their authorship, and it was Irenaeus, the heresy-hunting leader of the early church in France, who declared that only four of the many Gospels then in circulation were authentic. "And this is obviously true," he wrote, "because there are four corners of the universe and there are four principal winds." Paul Johnson, in his monumental History of Christianity, asserted that Irenaeus knew no more about the origins of the Gospels than we do, rather less, in fact. Johnson went on to describe the Gospels as literary documents that bear evidence of later tampering, editing, rewriting, and interpolation and backdating of theological concepts. Bart D. Ehrman, the distinguished professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, contends they are riddled with discrepancies, embellishments, made-up stories, and historical problems that mean they cannot be taken at face value as giving us historically accurate accounts of what really happened. The Gospel's depiction of Jesus' arrest and execution, says Ehrman, must be taken with a pound of salt. Numerous critical biblical scholars and contemporary historians have concluded that the evangelists and their editors in the early church consciously shifted the blame for Jesus' death from the Romans to the Jews in order to make Christianity more appealing to Gentiles living under Roman rule and less threatening to the Romans themselves. The two primary elements utilized by the gospel writers to blame Jews for the death of Jesus, and the trial before the Sanhedrin, and, of course, the tribunal before Pontius Pilate. The four canonical gospels each give a slightly different account of the encounter, but it is perhaps most illuminative to compare Mark's version to Matthew's. In Mark, Pilate reluctantly sentences Jesus to death at the urging of a Jewish crowd. But in Matthew, the crowd has suddenly become the whole people. Pilate washes his hands in front of them and declares himself innocent of Jesus' blood, to which the whole people reply, "Let his blood be on us and our children." So which version is accurate? Did the whole people really shout such an outlandish line without a single dissenting voice or not? And what about Pilate washing his hands? Did it happen? After all, it is no small detail. Obviously, both accounts cannot be correct. If one is right, the other is necessarily wrong. Some might argue that Matthew was simply more right than Mark, but this is an evasion. A reporter who made such a mistake would surely have been reprimanded by his editor, if not fired on the spot. The most plausible explanation is that the entire scene is a literary invention. The same is likely the case for the Gospels' inflammatory accounts of Jesus' appearance before the Sanhedrin. Religious scholar Reza Aslan, in his riveting biography of Jesus titled Zealot, asserts that the problems with the Gospels' accounts of a Sanhedrin trial are too numerous to count. The late Raymond Brown, a Catholic priest who was widely regarded as the greatest New Testament scholar of the late 20th century, found 27 discrepancies between the Gospels' accounts of the trial and rabbinic law. Boston University professor Paula Fredrickson, in her landmark Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, likewise questions the veracity of the Sanhedrin trial. Between their duties at the temple and their festive meals at home, these men would have put in a long day already, and besides, what need? Fredrickson is equally skeptical that there was a tribunal before the Roman prefect. Perhaps Jesus was interrogated briefly by Pilate, though this too is unlikely. There was no point. Aslan is more definitive on the question of an appearance before Pilate. No trial was held. No trial was necessary. There is perhaps no more compelling voice on this subject than John Dominic Crossan, the professor emeritus of religious studies at DePaul University and a former ordained priest. In Who Killed Jesus, he asks whether the Gospel's incendiary depiction of the tribunal before Pilate was a scene of Roman history or Christian propaganda. He answered the question, in part, with the following passage. "However explicable its origins, defensible its invectives, and understandable its motives among Christians fighting for survival, its repetition has now become the longest lie, and for our own integrity, we Christians must at last name it as such." But why revisit the tortured history of Christianity's relationship with Judaism? Because the longest hatred, the hatred born of the Gospel's depiction of the crucifixion, has risen again violently. So too has a brand of racially based political extremism that apologists refer to as populism. The two phenomena are undeniably linked. For proof, look no further than the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where white nationalists protesting the removal of a Confederate memorial chanted, "Jews will not replace us," as they marched by torchlight and snapped off stiff-armed Nazi salutes. Or the Tree of Life Synagogue in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh, where a white nationalist angry over Hispanic immigration murdered 11 Jews and wounded 6 more. Why did the gunman target Jews? Could it be that he was gripped by an irrational hatred even more powerful than his resentment of brown-skinned migrants looking for a better life in America? The brilliant economist Paul Krugman of the New York Times made the connection between the simultaneous rise of anti-Semitism and race-based populism in the same column that produced the quotation that appears in the epigraph of this work. "Most of us, I think, know that whenever bigotry runs free, we're likely to be among its victims." Unfortunately, the outbreak of a global pandemic, coupled with a sharp economic downturn, is likely to make matters worse. In the darkest corners of the internet, Jews are being blamed for the pandemic, just as they were blamed for the Black Death in the 14th century. "Never forget," Rabbi Jacob Zolli tells Gabriel during the opening scenes of the Order, "the unimaginable can happen." The outbreak of a global pandemic would seem to bear that out. But even before the COVID-19 crisis, anti-Semitism in Europe has risen to a level not seen since the middle of the last century. To their credit, Western European political leaders have roundly condemned the resurgence of anti-Semitism. So too has Pope Francis. He has also questioned the morality of unfettered capitalism, called for action on climate change, defended the rights of immigrants, and warned of the dangers posed by the rise of the European far right, which regards him as a mortal enemy. If only a prelate like Francis had been wearing the ring of the fisherman in 1939, the history of the Jews and the Roman Catholic Church might well have been written differently.
This is George Goodell. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Order, a novel by Daniel Silva, presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio. This program was directed by Robert Kessler. It was produced by Kessler Media Productions. Executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2020 by Daniel Silva. Production copyright 2020 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.